What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, in this podcast, we have a very interesting fellow. And you know, the whole idea that a lover scorned and you've never known the wrath and so forth. Well, I have found that those people within the Republican Party who feel that their party was hijacked by Donald Trump and they become these anti-Trumpers or Trumpsters, they are the most vehement in their concerns about what they see happening, even more so than Democrats. It's pretty remarkable. And this guest does that. Peter Wehner, a very smart guy involved with many religious movements on the conservative side. But when you hear him, he will be as determined and as articulate a spokesman for the anti-Trump movement of anyone you've ever heard. But most importantly in this particular podcast, his book is called The Death of Politics. And you're saying to yourself, what does that mean? We always have to have a political process. But if we try to define, John, because we talk about politics all the time, but have you ever heard anybody of late really trying to define what does that term mean? No. Or if somebody says, I'm a politician, what does that mean?
Well, that means turn around and run.
I mean, their hand is out for a donation.
That's right.
No, but seriously, John, I mean, when somebody says to you, I'm a doctor, I'm an electrician, right. I'm a plumber, I'm a podcaster.
Right, you get it.
Yeah, you get that. But what does a politician do all day, or what are they trying to build toward? And I've got to tell you, I heard Jim Mattis, the former defense secretary, and he's written a new book. And I thought he did a marvelous job because he's trying to stay out of some of the immediacy of what do you think about Donald Trump and working for him and such. But he will answer the larger questions. And what he rues today in America is the fact that, okay, it's okay to have a battle, if you will, during an election cycle. But when it's over, Democrats, Republicans, independents, socialists, whatever, you've got to come together. And you've got to govern and you've got to solve problems and you have to figure out how to lead and bring consensus. So even if you disunite during a campaign, your job is to reunite during the course of your governance.
Well, do you think it's the quality of candidates we're getting? We seem to get people who may be great on TV and great with the sound bites, but when they get in office, they kind of let us down, and we've gotten let down so many times.
Yeah, but John, we ask so little of them because if they entertain us, if they throw out a good couple of barbs, if they really know how to use the medium, go back as early as the 1960s and you realize that we were building this approach to politics that was all telegenic.
Right. It was all about looks. It was about, you know, who didn't sweat when they were asking the question. And
yeah, exactly. I mean, because Richard Nixon won a debate on radio, lost it on television. Well, you say, how can that be? Well, pictures really are commanding. And so a lot is built around photo opportunities, around characters, making them larger than life on television. I mean, why was it, and I think we could argue this point, that there were 13, 14, 15 more qualified individuals on a stage with Donald Trump last time offering policy solutions of a conservative nature, and they were dismissed with his barbs, three words, you know, you're too slow or lazy Jeb or whatever he was. No, seriously. And they were cast aside. Their ideas were never heard.
Yeah, well, it's because he knows how to use the medium.
Exactly. So, exactly.
Which is a problem because we need to get better candidates. So, I mean, we talk to brilliant people here and I say, we got such brilliant people around. It's so smart, you know, from the talk show and stuff. And yet, when we go to for president or even for governor or something, we seem to get the lowest common denominator.
Well, it's interesting because another thing that Jim Mattis says in his book, and then I'll get to Peter's book, which is the one we're really focused on. And he said, if you don't read, you can't lead. And he's saying that in the military, we ask so much of our young recruits and to be so schooled in so many technological advances that the military has made. And yet, if you're not reading, you're going to lead them into situations, not that you can't, having been well read, but at least you have enough history and enough context to make better decisions. But Peter Wehner thinks that the current occupant of the Oval Office is a destructive figure, but also a symptom of a diseased state of our politics. So he's written this book, The Death of Politics, and what he has to say is really worth hearing because he's doing it with a great deal of regret and discouragement about his own party, his own conservative brand, and he's wondering how to get it back. But I do at the end, or toward the end, John, he's very hopeful that the American people will make the adjustment, the experiment that we call the American democracy will rise up and do the right thing. Having said that, I ask him, John, what I consider to be the $64,000 question. So listen for that, but you've got to either stay till the end or shuttle to the end to hear that. But it's worth hearing, believe me.
Well, I hope he's right about it. It straightens out because right now we're so polarized that I don't see anybody coming to the center. I don't see anybody worrying about the massive debt, the poor medical system we have. I mean, we've really flushed our medical system down the toilet. You know, I mean, it's sad.
Well, there are problems festering while we're fighting and ignoring what politics is meant to be. And he's saying now that politics really has become an arena for insult, abuse, pettiness, not principles and ideals. And politics rewards the flamethrower. So we're going to talk to a man who is anything but a flamethrower, a really thoughtful individual. Peter Wehner, The Death of Politics, today on America Trends.
On the line with us on America Trends is Peter Wehner. He's got a new book, The Death of Politics, How to Heal Our Fractured Republic After Trump. And it would be really helpful, Peter, I think, if you let people know where you come from politically and morally. I mean, you've looked at a lot of very serious issues that involve religion and politics over the years. And I know you have great consternation about where we are today, reflected in this book with a tinge of hope. But it's a difficult time, you certainly tell us. And explain to us what you think is happening today and how we arrived at this place.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you. Let me start by talking a little bit about myself and maybe place myself within a political context, which may help listeners understand where I'm coming from. So I'm a lifelong conservative. I have been a lifelong Republican. My first vote for president was for Ronald Reagan in 1980. And I've served in three Republican administrations, the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations and the George W. Bush presidency. I was deputy director of speechwriting for a couple of years. And then I ran something called the Office of Strategic Initiatives, which was a kind of in-house White House think tank. So I have always identified as an adult with the Republican Party, the conservative cause. I've always considered myself a conservative before I considered myself a Republican, because the thing that attracted me to politics was the realm of ideas. And it seemed to me that the Republican Party was the political organization, institution, manifestation of conservatism. I'm also a person of the Christian faith. It's a longest journey that I started at the end of high school. So I've been a Christian my entire adult life as well. And so I've given a lot of thought to the intersection between faith and politics, what I think faith can contribute to politics, and what I think some of the dangers that are attendant to faith and politics are. The book is critical of Donald Trump. It's not an anti-Trump book. per se. Most of the book is on other issues. So I'm writing about politics, what's happened to it, why it's important, why it's worth defending, and what we can do to repair it. But I do write about Donald Trump because I think it'd be an affectation to ignore him. I was one of the first, at least quasi-prominent Republicans, to state that I wouldn't vote for Donald Trump under any circumstances. I wrote that in a New York Times column back in January of 2016. And it's for a variety of reasons we can get into, but one of the reasons is because I think Donald Trump is having a corrosive effect on our politics. As to how we got to this point in this place and to connect the two, I don't argue and don't believe that Donald Trump is simply responsible for the low state of American politics today. I think that would be unfair. A lot of these trends predated Trump. But what I do argue is that he has made virtually all of them worse. And there are deep currents that have been in place that have gotten us to this present moment. Polarization, tremendous deep economic changes, probably on the order of what we experienced during the Industrial Revolution, profound cultural changes, which is elicited, I think, a lot of fear among conservatives and Christians who feel like the country that they knew is beginning to be lost. So I think it's a complicated set of reasons that explain how we got where we got. I do think we're at a low moment in modern politics. This is also a book about hope, because I think we can get out of this situation. I think we have to, that we have to shake off feelings of corrosive cynicism and despair, because I don't think they're warranted, and B, if we don't change that, there's going to be huge costs, because if we get our politics wrong, there's a lot of disaster can follow.
Are you more disappointed in the conservative movement having given in to many of Donald Trump's ill-formed policies, very little thought behind them? I know you used to convene intellectuals in the White House to inform George W. Bush, and that's something that excites you about politics. Or are you more disappointed in the evangelicals who you say, in many cases, are not giving Christian witness to what is right in front of them in terms of the moral lapses of this man?
I'm disappointed and troubled by both for some similar reasons. I would say that the most personally painful thing to me is what's happened with the evangelical Christian movement, partly because I'm a person of faith and my faith is more important than my politics, but both are very important to me. I think the hypocrisy and the double standards that we're seeing in the evangelical Christian world is so pronounced, so obvious, so undeniable, and I think so discrediting that it leaves me shaking my head. I should put in an important qualifier here. I've never begrudged Christians who are conservatives for voting for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. I didn't make that choice because I thought that I didn't vote for either one because as I said earlier, I couldn't in good conscience vote for Donald Trump. But I understood their argument, and it goes something like this. Donald Trump is a deeply flawed and corrupt human being. You know, that's unfortunate, but his agenda is going to pursue ends that we think are good for our agenda and for the good of the country. So if you're pro-life, you have a traditional conservative view on the role of the courts in our country, deregulation and taxes and on a whole range of issues, you'd say, you know, in the balance, net-net, he would be better than having someone like Hillary Clinton in the Oval Office. I get that argument. What really disturbs me about evangelicals is that they have become essentially uncritical of Donald Trump. They don't seem to be able to hold two ideas at the same time, which is that you can praise him if you think that his policies are helpful and are doing good, say on court appointments, but at the same time, be willing to speak truth to power and to say that the avalanche of lies and the deceptions, the dehumanization, the cruelty, the crudity that is so characteristic of Donald Trump and his presidency, those things are wrong, and we have to say that they're wrong. Instead, what you have with a lot of evangelical leaders, Franklin Graham, Eric Metaxas, Robert Jeffress, Ralph Reed, James Dobson, and others, Jerry Falwell Jr., who are not only, go sotto voce, go silent in the face of Trump's corruptions, they actually are defending him all the time. So that, I think, is tremendously discrediting. I think it's harmful to our politics. I think it's harmful to the faith. And as I said, it's just so nakedly and transparently hypocritical. Many of these people were folks who used a 2x4 against Bill Clinton. And I remember I was part of those debates, and they said day after day after day, hour after hour after hour, that character mattered, that integrity mattered, that corruption mattered. But when it comes to Donald Trump, that seems not to be the case. And what that has revealed to me is that for many of them, not all of them, but for many of them, the arguments they made were simply partisan weapons, that morality was not an end in itself, but it was a means to an end. So if morality can be used against a liberal, then use it. But if morality would undermine a Republican, then leave it alone. So that's really troubled me. The conservative movement is similar. I don't think Donald Trump is a conservative. I think some of his policies, like protectionism, are antithetical to conservatism. But conservatism is also a sensibility, a temperament, an approach to life. And it has traditionally taken great interest in the care of our civic and political culture. And Donald Trump is having a corrosive effect on that, an acidic effect, a toxic effect on those things. And yet conservatives don't seem bothered by it. And indeed, and to some extent in my experience, it's maybe yours observation as well, I don't know, but there are parts of how Trump conducts himself that not only don't repel conservatives and evangelicals, it seems to be a selling point for him. It's a feature, not a bug. They seem to believe, I know this from conversations I've had with close friends who are Trump supporters, they feel like they, the conservative movement, the evangelical world, has been dishonored, humiliated, viewed in a patronizing and contemptuous way. And to some extent, that's fair. The elite culture has had some of those views toward conservatives and evangelical Christians. But what's happened is that's given rise to deep, powerful, almost overwhelming feelings of grievance, anger, resentments. And they view Trump as a guy who's going to bring a gun to a knife fight. And I've heard a version of this during the campaign and since Trump has become president, which is George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney were good men, people of certainly a better character overall than Donald Trump. But they're too genteel. They didn't want to destroy the left like Trump does, because they don't understand the threat posed by the left. So I think that's led them into all sorts of dark alleyways.
I wonder if he's really trying to destroy the left or just anyone who dares to go against him personally or his policies. I'm not certain whether he has reacted to your book and many other never Trumpers. I mean, when you think of the George Wills and you think of the Bill Kristols, many conservatives are out there. Of course, Nicole Wallace, who worked with you in the White House, Joe Scarborough. I mean, there are so many Republicans. How were you feeling during the Obama presidency, which had none of this rancor in terms of, denigration of individuals, enjoying the incitement of anger, which you see today? I'm just wondering how you look at that. I mean, you didn't agree with the Obama policies, I'm sure, in many ways, but on balance, what were you feeling over those 8 years, or why were you not feeling perhaps the same level of anger that those who've come into the Trump group and categorically the 40% who will never leave him no matter what he says or does?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's interesting to look back. Because I'm a conservative, I was critical of some of what Barack Obama did for sure, but in the policy realm, I always respected Obama's disposition and his temperament. And I was intrigued with his mind. I think he's a very thoughtful person. And I think at his best, he was able to articulate different sides of an argument. There were moments during his presidency where he almost seemed to be a commentator on events in terms of describing things. One of the things that did frustrate me is that President Obama would characterize Republicans in ways during his presidency that I thought were unfair and caricatured and sometimes crossed the line. Certainly nothing compared to what Trump has done. And all presidents do that to some extent. It really is a question of where on the spectrum that they fall. I did feel like Obama had something of a bait and switch that he ran. I would say the central theme of the Obama campaign in 2008 was overcoming the polarization and partisanship of politics, that he would be this unifying figure and make us whole and make us one. That was, I think, just central to what his selling point was. And I didn't feel like he governed in that manner. And I can't recall a single time where he really took on the left in any way in terms of when they would cross rhetorical lines and portray Republicans in ways that I think were unfair. One of the things I argue in the book, and this is true for Republicans and Democratic presidents, and it's one of the ways where I think we have to begin to overcome polarization, is you need people in your own tribe with influence, with authority in your own tribe, your own political institution, to take on those within your own tribe and your own political institution. And to, in a sense, say, look, we agree on a lot of things, but here you've crossed a line, or here you're being unfair. It just doesn't help if you have a conservative president lecture liberals about civility and never his own side, or vice versa. If you have a liberal president lecture only conservatives on civility and bipartisanship and never challenges her own side. And I think Obama could have done that. He had the power to do it. In some sense, he had moral authority with the left to do it. So the country was more polarized under Obama at the end of his presidency than at the beginning. But again, these are trends that are not simply a product of Obama. The country itself, our politics, has become more polarized for a whole variety of reasons. Bill Bishop, who's a journalist, wrote a book called The Big Sort, which talks about how we have over decades been sorting ourselves more and more ideologically, geographically, through lifestyle. And you just don't have what you did a generation or two ago, which is conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. So we've kind of sorted ourselves. And if you check the polarization data with presidents, you would see that Bill Clinton was more polarizing than George H.W. Bush. George W. Bush was more polarizing than Bill Clinton. Barack Obama was more polarizing than George W. Bush. So again, these are trends that have been in motion. But I think what Trump has done, really in a way that no other president has, he seems to relish the polarization. He's made no effort to reach out to people beyond his base. And he seems to get a psychic satisfaction out of creating acrimony, antipathy, and division. I think it's a deep psychological problem that he has. I think he has a disordered personality. I have almost no question that that's the case. And I think we're seeing it play out in all sorts of ways, and that's one of them.
The Death of Politics, How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. Peter Wehner is with us. And Peter, I agree with you on so many of these points. And I do want to get into a definition of politics with you. But I do want to ask, when you look at Donald Trump, the whole idea that he just wanted to be acknowledged as president, doesn't want anything about his 2016 run to be diminished by Russian interference, any of that. So obviously, as the campaign goes on, he cares most about getting reelected, which would really solidify his place in the political realm as being somewhat miraculous in all of this. Having said that, why is he not getting the message? In 2018, in my view,
given all the gerrymandering, there was no way that the Democrats were to take back the House of Representatives, except for a lot of suburban women reacting to the messaging that you're talking about here and being so turned off by it that they had just written him off. They turned the channel, as Pete Buttigieg said, saying, I can't listen to this anymore. It's too demeaning, too degrading, too shrill. Is he going to change during this period just for expediency? And will anyone beyond the 40% buy that?
Yeah, he won't change. One of the arguments I made in warning some of my Republican friends, including members of Congress, about Trump, you may recall this, that during the campaign, there was a lot of talk that once he secured the Republican nomination, both de facto, which was, I think, after the Indiana primary in the spring, and then, in fact, during the summer of 2016, you heard a lot of Republicans say that he would grow in office, that that he would be more controlled and contained, that he acted the way he did and used the attacks the way he did in order to win the nomination. But once that happened, he would change. I never believed that. I just didn't think he'd have the personality and emotional profile to change. And indeed, he not only hasn't changed, he's gotten worse. His worst tendencies have continued. So I don't think he's going to change. His presidency has been exactly as the campaign has been. It's been one divisive thing after another, hitting one cultural flashpoint after after another. I don't think he's capable of changing, even if he wanted to. I don't think he wants to. And so I think any hopes that that he's going to alter his mode or his style of governing is silly. And the idea that some of my friends had, which was that he could be contained and controlled, was also equally silly. And I think you've seen that now with chief of staff after chief of staff having been run through. Reince Priebus, John Kelly, now Mick Mulvaney, who's an acting chief of staff, who's essentially given up on trying to control Trump, control the Twitters, control the outbursts, and all the rest. He's a deeply volatile and unstable human being. And so he couldn't have been contained in any event. But certainly once he won the presidency, doing it the way he did, there was no way that he was going to take the counsel of other people who argued he had to take a different tack. I agree with you in terms of the 2018 election, and you're exactly right. The real worrisome sign, it seems to me, if you're a Republican, is that hemorrhage of female suburban voters, many of whom have been traditionally Republican. They got utterly decimated in the midterm elections. I live in Virginia, in McLean, just to take one illustration, the 10th district, congressional district in McLean, and Barbara Comstock was a representative there. She was reasonably popular. Hillary Clinton, it's a purple district, leaning somewhat Democratic. Hillary Clinton won that district in 2016 against Trump, I think about 3 points or something like that. And Barbara won fairly easily in 2016, her reelection. I think she won by 5-7 points, something like that. In 2018, she lost, Barbara Comstock lost by, I think, 12 points to the Democrat. That was almost entirely because of Donald Trump and the effects that Trump had on suburban voters. I mean, I was one, just to take me as an illustration. I didn't vote for Barbara Comstock. I know her. I like her. In any usual, normal situation, I would have been a reliable Comstock voter. But I voted against her in part because I felt like there had to be institutional accountability on Donald Trump. I didn't think that some of what I think are the more radical policies of the left were going to get through. I knew they wouldn't because Donald Trump was president, would veto them, and there was a Republican Senate. But what I did feel quite strongly about is that there had to be institutional accountability over Trump, and the Republicans in the House were simply not supplying that. And so I voted Democratic, for the first time. And I'm glad I did. And in addition to that, if Trumpism is to be rolled back at any point, and the conservatism, as I understand conservatism, is to rise again, Trump has to lose, and people who line up behind Trump politically have to lose as well. If he keeps winning, it's going to validate his approach to politics, his approach to philosophy. He doesn't have a clue of what the philosophy of conservatism is. But there's no question that in my mind, he's fundamentally changing the American right in all sorts of bad ways. And I think he has to be defeated.
And we will get back to that in a moment. But I think it's really interesting in your book, talking about many great thinkers about politics, whether it's Locke or Lincoln, whatever it may be. You're helping in this book to educate us, because I think a lot of people, Peter, have forgotten what is the role of politics. I mean, we think of politicians, and we have this kind of awful perception that they're all out for themselves. They only care about reelection. They'll say anything to get elected. And now we add this coarseness to the conversation, and you say to yourself, how can we have respect? And yet, politics, you know, I watched that HBO series Chernobyl recently, and I was reminded how serious politics is, even when politics tries to take away any concerns about health and safety for a state message and a collective voice. And you say to yourself, politics is damn serious. And yet in America for a long time, we thought it was a parlor game because, well, we can do pretty well on our own. But politics means something. Would you help my audience understand how important politics really is to just the human condition?
Yeah, it is one of the things that I deal with in the book, and it's really been one of my deep convictions throughout my life on exactly this point, which is why politics is so essential. I mean, a simple way to understand it is politics, from the ancient Greeks, it's where we get the term. It means the affairs of the city. And we associate it, rightly so, with governing and debates and parties battling for power, choosing the politicians who are going to run our government. And that's all correct. That's all part of it. But politics, in a deeper sense, is how we live together in a free society and how we govern ourselves at every level. And politics matters because it is finally and fundamentally about justice. Now, that's not all that politics is about. There are a lot of components to it. There are dark undersides to politics. I understand that. There are people who are scoundrels in politics, like there are people who are scoundrels in every profession. But what politics is about is really the pursuit of justice. The founders, Madison, talks about it in the Federalist Papers, where he said government is really about the driving toward politics. And it's if you get your politics wrong, there can be a huge human cost. So much of what we love and care for and treasure and cherish can be swept away if you get politics badly wrong. And you can see that obviously throughout history. I mean, you can look at Germany in the pre-World War II period. And during the Nazi regime, you can see the difference between North and South Korea. You can see it all over the world. Politics can be an instrument of human flourishing, or an instrument of human decimation. And so that really matters. And if you do get politics right, that really does allow for the protection of human dignity. And the chance in this country, as we've always understood politics, to live our lives the way that we want. One of my concerns about Donald Trump is he's taken an enlarged view in the moral imagination of and life of this country and the citizens of this country. Politics was never meant to be as dominant as it is now. It's what it really should do, in my estimation, is get some things right that allow us to go on and live our lives in the non-political sphere of family and friendships and human relationships and little leagues and book clubs and Bible studies. You know, that's really where, and our professions. But Trump, to some extent, has changed that. And while I don't think he's an authoritarian, I don't think our institutions are allowing him to be an authoritarian, I think you get a sense of what it's like to live under an authoritarian regime, because they have utter and complete dominance in the life of people, and the leaders themselves want to be the focus and of everybody's attention, and that I think is deeply problematic. At the end of the book, I quote a speech, one of my favorite speeches, that Bobby Kennedy gave in 1966. It was his speech at the University of Cape Town. Just to set the context of that, apartheid was in place in South Africa at that time, and Kennedy went on a 5-day trip to South Africa, which was a huge event, both because he was a Kennedy, because he was a senator. And no one had ever paid that much attention to the evils of apartheid, at least from the West. And Kennedy gave a speech at the University of Cape Town, mostly with young people, and he warned against dangers of futility, is what he referred to it as. And then he went on to say that every time a person stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he creates a tiny ripple of hope, and that those ripples of hope together can build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression. And it's beautiful language, but it goes to a much deeper point, which is that we have it within ourselves, individuals, to stand up for ideals, to act to improve the lot of others, to strike out against injustice. And when we do that, when enough people do it, you can change things for the better. I write in the book that one person acting alone may not be able to do much, but a lot of people acting together can create a culture of politics, a culture of a society, and that can go a very long ways toward determining how noble and how humane and how decent our country is. And we have to do it. One of the things that worries me and what I push back against in this book is a sense of fatalism, a sense that people just throw up their hands in despair and say there's nothing we can do. That's not right. We have it within our power to write wonderful new chapters in the American story. And this is a self-governing republic. Whatever else you think about politics in America, the members of Congress and in the political class are responsive to the demands of their constituents. I think it's a facile argument to say that our country is fine and our politics is broken. I actually think that our politics is broken and angry because, to some extent, our country is broken and angry. And so what politics is a stage in which that plays out and in which we see it. But we can change that. And it's also extremely important. You know, this is a book about ideas, but it's also a book that I've written about stories, some of mine, but most of them of others. And a reminder of some of the great figures in American history and some of the great stories of American history and how we've been in more difficult situation in the past than we are today. I mean, if you think that our elections are acrimonious, you go back and read about the election between Jefferson and Adams in 1800, which is the first contested election in American history. That was a brutal affair. It nearly tore apart the young republic, as historians have written. We have the Civil War, 700,000 people killed in a country of less than 30 million people. That would be the equivalent today of 7 million people die. Or the late 60s and early 70s, you run through some of what happened at that time in our history, really a compressed period. The civil rights struggle, the cities that were burning, campuses that were under siege, students taking over administration. You had Kent State, the shooting of the National Guard at Kent State, where students were killed in the early 70s, the March on the Pentagon. Democratic convention in Chicago in 68, where there was blood on the streets, the death of assassination of Martin Luther King in April, and then Bobby Kennedy in June of 68. There were, in a period, I found this out in researching the book, in an 18-month period between 1971 and 72, there was an average of 5 domestic bombings a day in the United States. Now, we're not at that point today, so we can overcome this, but it's going to take will, it's going to take persistence, it's going to take intentionality. And what is different now, more different than in the past, is Donald Trump, because we've never had a president quite like him. So the challenges are sui generis. They're unique to our time. But we aren't like corks caught in an ocean, the currents of an ocean, where we have no control over them. We can shape the future, and we have to begin to act locally, at the state level, at the national level, in every area of our lives.
And Peter, I do agree with you. However, I do want to bring it back in closing. I know in your closing, you do talk about hope, and you do talk about the fact that it's not just the politicians who've got to change the course of our dialogue, conversation, openness to understanding the other tribe and so forth, but it's up to us. But my question is, I mean, the president, as you say, has so flooded the zone with so much misinformation and misdirection that people are so confused, and there's just an overwhelming sense that they've been overtaken and they don't know what to be angry at. You know, you fire at this and fire at that. But what if Donald Trump, and you talk about the mantle of citizenship, what will it say about America, and what are the prospects for the American experiment going forward? If he's reelected, what does that say about the people, not only about Donald Trump?
Yeah, it would be an indictment, I think, against the public. And I worry about that. I do hope that the Democrats do enough to you know, their part to keep him from being elected, because I think if they go in a radical direction and nominate somebody of the left, that's going to put a lot of Americans in a situation that we were talking about earlier, that feel like, look, I can't in good conscience vote for somebody like, say, Bernie Sanders, who's a democratic socialist. But I take your point, and really that was what this book is about. If Donald Trump I think 4 years of Donald Trump can be viewed as an anomaly. 8 years of Donald Trump is a pattern, and I think a very disturbing pattern. And I think what it would do is it would validate his style of politics, and I think it would validate a certain approach to politics and to one another, a kind of indecency, dehumanization, incivility. And what really worries me, maybe above all, in terms of the personification of Trump and Trumpism, which is what I refer to in the book is his commitment to try and kill the idea of truth itself. That is, I don't think that Donald Trump is simply engaged in assault on truth. I think he's trying to annihilate truth and falsity as categories. And what I mean by that is that he will say things that are demonstrably and empirically false, that we know are untrue. I use as an example the dawn of the Trump presidency, in that debate about the crowd size for the inauguration, when Trump and his lackeys, Sean Spicer and others who went out, Kellyanne Conway, and insisted that his inaugural crowd was larger than Obama's. We knew it wasn't. There were aerial photographs that showed it wasn't. There were park service videos that showed it wasn't. But that didn't matter. They went after it, and they insisted that it wasn't true. You're going to believe me or your lying eyes. Now, if you have that happening with a president day after day after day, that creates a kind of disorientation in the public. And there's so many lies that we know from neuroscience that your brain begins to sort of shut down. You can't absorb and refute all of these lies. And if that continues, then you get into very, very dangerous territory, because you're not having a debate over a common set of facts and having a discussion and dialogue about how do we fix these problems, you're talking about people who live in different realities, and that's very, very dicey. So if the American people choose to reelect Trump, if that's what they do, I think that there will be a real and long and durable cost to that. But I will say, in my experience here, and some of this is anecdotal, but I think it's also backed up by the data, I think that there is a large counterreaction to Trump. The way I put it in the book is that sometimes viruses create their own antibodies. And I think our civic and political antibodies are kicking in. And I think you saw some of that evidenced in the 2018 election. I think most of the country, not Trump's core supporters, which is roughly 40% of the voting public, but most of the rest of the country are exhausted and embarrassed and ashamed of what the country has become because of Donald Trump and who he is. And my gut instinct is that will carry the day and that they won't reelect him. But we don't know that. And as I said, the Democrats are going to have some say in that, depending on who they nominate and how that nominee conducts themselves during the election.
Well, as we record this before the 4th of July, and we look forward to a review of the tanks by President Trump, that might be it, the death of politics in America, how to heal our frayed republic after Trump. Peter Wehner, I can't thank you enough for being with us today. I know this book had to be a tough one to write, and you've thought so much about it, and I really recommend that people read this, The Death of Politics, Peter Wehner, Wehner. Thank you for being on America Trends.
I enjoyed the conversation very much. Thanks so much.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, MHNRnetwork.com.